Investing involves risk. The value of an investment and the income from it may fall as well as rise, and investors might not get back the full amount invested. Past performance is not a reliable indicator of future results. The mention of any particular security or strategy should not be considered as a recommendation. For further information on the Brunner Trust, please go to www.brunner.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to the seventh and latest installment of Connected Investor, the podcast from the Brunner Investment Trust. I'm Joe Lynham, a BBC presenter who was a business correspondent for very many years. And in this podcast, we're going to tackle a whole myriad of issues which may affect you, the markets, and of course, the Brunner Fund. And I'm joined, as ever, by Matthew Tillett, the lead portfolio manager of Brunner Investment Trust in the office. Matthew, welcome back to the office, or is that commiserations to be back to the office?
No, it's good to be back, Joe. Good to be back, and good to see you as well.
We're going to take a deeper look at the second most important country in economic terms in the world, China, where there appears to be something of a big shift by the ruling Communist Party this year. For three decades, it had looked the other way as some of its citizens became billionaires, so long as jobs were created and no one strayed into politics. But suddenly that blind eye has opened up, and we've seen a few examples of swift action against high-profile millionaires and even entire sectors within the Chinese economy. President Xi Jinping refers to it as his common prosperity drive. What do you think? What do you make of it, Matthew?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's happening, Joe, is that the government has become increasingly concerned with not so much the pace of growth, but the path of economic growth in China. So it's becoming it's become rather unbalanced and is accentuating the inequalities within the society. And I think from their perspective, they obviously have this tacit understanding with the population that, you know, they stay in power, but everybody gets a lot wealthier over time and living standards improve. But if it starts to look like that's only happening for segments of the population, that the lower and middle classes become disaffected, then that's potentially a major problem for them and you know, the mandate that they have to rule the country. So I think that's kind of what's behind some of these rulings and shifts in policy and changes in regulation that we've seen happen.
But to the outside world, Matthew, it does look as if China is tilting away from being a relatively open, but albeit politically communist country in order to do this protection of the ordinary man on the street or a man and woman on the street.
Yeah, I think that there definitely is an element of that going on, although I'd sort of perhaps caution a bit in sort of how open really was it before? I mean, it's always been essentially a dictatorship. You know, the government has effectively always been in control of pretty much every sector and yeah, I mean, really every company as well. I mean, you know, even these big kind of technology companies that you can invest in as Western investors. You know, when you buy those shares, American depository receipts in the US. Or indeed even the listings in Hong Kong, you know, most of these are structured in such a way that you don't actually have the property rights in the way that you do buying a share in the UK or in the US.
You don't actually own the shares that you're buying.
No, they use these complex structures called variable interest entities, which works a bit like a tracker share in the way that you sort of, you know, the shares kind of track the, you know, the value of the company, but there's no actual way of enforcing your right to that property. But people have been prepared to kind of look through that on the assumption that the Chinese government would never do that, that they would never, you know, they would never just, you know, expropriate property from foreign investors.
And can we continue to make that assumption, Matthew, that they won't expropriate?
Yeah, they need to find a balance because they need the outside world as well. So, I mean, you know, never say never. But if the government was to start, you know, doing things like that, then they would have real problem, you know, attracting inward investment, you know, buying goods and services from other parts of the world, you know, using technologies from other parts of the world, which they want to do and need to do. Yeah, they are integrated into the economy, the global economy as well. So I think it's unlikely that would happen. But this does lead into a broader question around investing in China and how one takes these factors into account. We in Brunner, we've not typically had much exposure to China, and that's not because we haven't, you know, looked hard and hadn't been interested. It's really because we've always struggled with this issue and the particularly the governance issue, the fact that, you know, it's just quite hard to find companies that have you know, the sort of standards that we look for, and the fact that, you know, you need to put a discount on it. You know, I think what this episode has shown is that you know, you don't have the same protections that you have in other parts of the world, and therefore, as an investor, if you're going to invest in it, you've got to put a discount on it. The question is how much of a discount do you put on it? Yeah, you know, before this started, there wasn't much discount. Now there is a very big discount, and you can, you know, on paper buy some, you know what look like very interesting companies that. For example, some of the technology platforms in China that have very rapid growth and long-term, excellent long-term growth prospects on you know, really quite attractive valuations now. So, you know, that's potentially an opportunity. But say, so you just got to decide how much of a discount you want to place for these issues.
So how much of a discount would you give, for example, the property company Evergrande?
Well, Evergrande is a kind of slightly different one. And this is of course, the other issue that's happening in China at the moment. I mean, Evergrande is a very big company in terms of, you know, its impact on its the size of its balance sheet and the impact that it has on the economy, because it's the largest real estate developer. It's, you know, enormously financially leveraged and is almost certainly going to need some sort of complicated financial rescue from the government in order to get it out of the situation that it's in. But I think this issue that what we're seeing with happening with Evergrande is it kind of illustrates the conflict that exists within the Chinese growth model that's existed for probably 10 or 15 years now, which is that on the one hand, the government has has this agreement with the population. Tacit agreement that, you know, you basically double living standards every 10 years, and that needs 6 or 7% economic growth. But at the same time, the government also wants growth to be what they call it reliable. That's the term that they use. It's sort of really sort of sustainable, what we call sustainable growth in the West, which is growth that's driven by consumption, increases in consumer wealth and consumer spending, and technology as well. As opposed to just, you know, the building of more bridges or the building of more apartments. The problem is that sort of growth is very, very difficult to achieve, that sort of growth at rates any more than 2 or 3%. And that's what we know from economic history. So every time they look like they're not getting near the 6 or 7%, the government tends to relax the rules and you know, you get these kind of property booms and these infrastructure booms. But then they row back on it, which is what they've been doing more recently when they want to stop it. And then that creates problems for companies like Evergrande that are involved in it. But it is an inherent conflict, and it can't go on forever. At some point, you know, the country will have to move to a lower growth path. That's my view.
And the danger, of course, with that is that the West has become addicted to Chinese investment and Chinese growth. In that respect. But what will this realignment that I spoke about, what will it mean for the markets and what will it mean for the West? I mean, could the decoupling of China from the West, if it is a decoupling, could it lead to a surge in inflation, for example?
So I guess it sort of depends to what extent it happens. I mean, if we're talking about, you know, Evergrande being the sort of catalyst for China's growth to decelerate from 7% to 1-2%, and that's where it stays for the next, you know, forever, then that's a very, very significant event for financial markets, because, I mean, that would have significant for everything from, you know, commodity prices and commodity markets to, you know, luxury goods and industrial companies that sell into China, because it's just such a big market, and it's a market that everyone is assuming is going to grow at, more than all the other markets around the world. I'm not sure Evergrande is the catalyst for that. I mean, I suspect what happens is the government, but and I imagine they've got a plan to some sort of rescue involving, socializing the liabilities, getting other private and public property companies to take on the liabilities, and then I imagine things will may not carry on exactly as they were before, but in the same sort of way. But at some point, you cannot keep piling on debt forever. Eventually, the growth rate does have to slow. So we need to be prepared for that as investors. But I'm not sure Evergrande is the catalyst for that to happen, right now. I think in terms of your question about inflation, I think it's definitely something to be aware of, in that if you look at the low rates of inflation that we've had over the last 20, 30 years, a chunk of that is a result of globalization, and in particular the entry into the workforce of hundreds of millions of Chinese laborers moved from the country into the city, which has really started happening in the 90s and then through the 2000s and carried on. This is the kind of classic emerging market export-led growth model, where effectively you bring low-cost labor into the workforce, and you slowly move up the value chain, and you drive growth by exporting goods to the Western countries, and you do it at a lower cost than anyone else can do it, and that works for a long time. But once you get to the, and of course it has the effect of being quite deflationary, and that's what we've actually seen happen. The price of tradable goods has been quite deflationary for a long time. That's why we see these low rates of inflation in Western countries, because you have tradables goods prices which are flat declining, and then actually a lot of domestic service prices, the price of your haircut, the price of your train ticket, those have been going up. And it's really the average of the two is what is the inflation number that you see. Now going forward, that's we're not going to have that same deflationary force, because the labor cost arbitrage doesn't exist in the way that it existed before, because labor costs have gone up so much in China that the economics don't really stack up in the way they used to. And that's why you're seeing quite a lot of companies actually reshore their supply chains back to the US and back to Europe, because it makes sense for them to do that. Obviously the geopolitical issues play a role as well in that, but a lot of it is actually just driven by economics. So I don't think that's going to lead to a surge in inflation, but I certainly think it's less deflationary than what we have become accustomed to over the last 10 or 20 years.
Okay, well, stay with us, and we're going to move to talk about China as a global citizen. And in due course, we will also talk about the wider energy price surge that you made reference to as in costs. But let's take a pause. So Matthew Tillett, will this new posture that we've been speaking about in China change the company as a global citizen? It's no longer a developing or an emerging economy. So when it shifts its position in the global bed, the whole bed wakes up.
Yeah, I think it's a real challenge for China. And I to draw on the experience of economic history here, where there's quite a lot of evidence that when countries move from that sort of emerging market phase or less developed, however you want to call it, to what's usually termed the literal middle income, that's the bit where they sometimes it becomes difficult to sustain the growth. And it goes back a bit to what we were talking about just previously around that, that export-led growth model is a well-known formula, and it's been followed by many, many countries, but it only goes so far. Once you've pushed that as far as you can, you then need to find new avenues of growth. China, I think, has gone as far as they can pretty much with that model. And obviously the last 10 years or 15 years or so, it's been very much about domestic expenditure on infrastructure and real estate. Hence the you know, the problems that we're seeing with Evergrande, and you know, that, again, and that you can only do that so far, because you know, eventually you've got to find other things. So I think they do need to find new avenues for growth, and at some point they'll probably need to settle for a lower rate of growth going forward. And it doesn't seem to me that they've quite worked that out yet, in terms of, you know, how they're actually going to handle that transition.
Now, the E in ESG, Matthew, is important here because we have a big summit coming up tackling climate change. It's going to be held in Glasgow. It's called COP26, starting at the start of November. Can the global community rely on China to fulfill any promises that it may or may not make at COP26?
Well, they've talked about 2060 targets, I think, that they've put out. Net zero, I think. But obviously that's a long way off. Very long way off. And in the medium term or near term, energy demand in China is still growing and still going to grow significantly. And they are still very dependent on fossil fuels, including coal, actually. Coal is, you know, a pretty significant chunk of the energy mix. And there's even been a new coal power stations built. I think there are even some still being built now. So it is a very big polluter, and is going to increase rather than decrease in the near term. So, you know, I think I the way I see it is we've got to be realistic about it. You know, they're not going, China and other emerging market countries are not going to stop growing because of ESG. You know, they have got populations that want to get richer, want to get wealthier. And at the moment, you know, use of fossil fuels is still the easiest way to do that, to satisfy the energy demand. So the best thing we can do is try to develop the alternatives to fossil fuels as quickly as possible, so that then we can, you know, we can sort of bring them into the energy mix.
Well, that's a really good point to pause for a moment. And in a moment, we'll take on that discussion about carbon and talk about energy prices outside China. Now, in this segment, Matthew, I would like, if we could, to talk about the surge in energy prices. We've seen in this country, in the United Kingdom, queuing for petrol and diesel. It may be more closely related to Brexit and the disappearing lorry drivers have gone back to Europe following the full exit of Britain from the European Union. But energy prices have been rising all over the world, and that could have an impact, especially on inflation.
Yeah, you're right. They have been rising a lot. And I think there's sort of two things going on here. There's kind of some short-term issues, which may well kind of resolve themselves, but there's also some longer term factors as well. So, I mean, in the short term, what we're seeing is recovering demand all around the world as, you know, economies reopen. But also there's some sort of peculiarities around to do with things like gas storage. So for gas, the storage levels are unusually low. And then at the same time, we've also had just a not very good period for renewables, particularly here in the UK, actually, where, you know, just the wind hasn't been blowing, which you know, is you know, sounds flippant, but I mean, it's actually kind of illustrates, you know, one of the problems with, you know, I know our Prime Minister has, you know, put a lot of weight on wind power being our, you know, how we're going to decarbonize, and you know, I'm supportive of that, but we need to kind of keep in mind the fact that, you know, it is a, you know, it's an intermittent source of energy, and mm-hmm. and you know, when it's not available, until we have some kind of reliable scale storage solution, you know, we are going to be vulnerable to these sorts of situations, because when it's not available, you know, suddenly you've got a shortage, and I mean, it doesn't take very much. The demand is very inelastic for energy, so you only need a small shortage, and suddenly the prices. Yeah, prices go up enormously because they need to in order to ration demand. So that's sort of the short term stuff. But then I think longer term, there's also, you know, there has been a real lack of investment in this industry. Initially, it started around 2014 when we had the crash in the oil price and gas prices as well, which was driven by the sort of the immediate cause of it was the growth of US shale and then the decision by OPEC to effectively try and outcompete shale. And that was really a sort of regime change as far as the fossil fuel industry was concerned, because it suddenly just changed the whole pricing dynamic, and the industry really had to kind of change the way it behaves, because the previous 10 years had been an investment boom where they'd spent loads of money on new projects, many of which have turned out to basically be uneconomic or may make very low returns. And ever since then, the industry has been much more focused on financial metrics like return on capital and value per share. And so there's and shale has been holding the companies to account as well. So it just hasn't been really the same level of investment. But it takes a long time in this industry for those sorts of things to come through, because the projects themselves can take 5 to 10 years to fully come online, particularly the large projects. So it's only really kind of last year and now that we're coming to the end of some of those big projects that were sanctioned in 2012, 2013, 2014. And so looking forward, we don't really have that much new supply coming on. And demand is still, still very resilient and as I said, recovering. So to me, like, it's that point is more of a concern, actually, rather than, I think those shorter term issues, it will probably work themselves out. Some of them are just a bit random. Maybe some of them do with, Brexit and in this country and some of the supply chain issues, but they should work themselves out in time. But the longer term questions, that's harder to correct, without new investment. And then on top of that, of course, we have the ESG dimension as well, which makes it, even harder for listed fossil fuel companies to, but basically, most of the ones in Europe are basically no longer investing really in new fossil fuels, because they need to transition their businesses away from fossil fuels. So I think it's a bit of a wake-up call, actually, for everyone who's interested in this, and anybody who, politicians, kind of, ESG departments, because it does show that, we are still reliant on these sources of energy. And if we yeah. pretend that we're not, then the danger is we kind of end up in these situations. When the general public starts seeing their gas bills go up 50% or 100%, they may not be as supportive for, some of the policies that we need. So I think everybody needs to be a bit more practical about the situation and the challenge that we face.
Okay. In a moment, I'm going to ask you about the performance of the Brunner Investment Trust. But very briefly, do you think interest rates, be they American, European or British, are heading north as a result of some of the pressures that we've already spoken about?
Well, I'm not sure they go north as a result of these pressures, actually, because the central bank's mandate tends to focus on, what they think of as the basic inflation X, all of these things. It's not really supply side. They don't really respond to supply side driven shocks. It's more demand side. And most of this stuff is actually supply side driven. And that's the narrative that they're talking about at the moment, really, about it all being transitory. I think only the passage of time will tell whether it really is transitory. I mean, my view, I think quite a bit of it is transitory, but I don't think all of it is transitory. I think some of it probably is here to stay. And therefore, we probably do have slightly higher levels of inflation than we've had in the past. Whether that leads to materially higher interest rates is another question, though, because every time central banks have tried to raise interest rates over the last, ever since the financial crisis, it's not really worked, because
tantrums,
as soon as they've started doing
paper
it.
Paper tantrums and all that.
And that may well happen again, in which case we may not get very far down the road of raising interest rates before they have to be cut again.
So much for completely independent central banks. Anyway, let me ask you about the Brunner Investment Trust. How has it performed over the last few months? And I see that the share price on the London Stock Exchange is now solidly above £10.
Yeah, pleased with the performance of the trust. Stock picking's been good this year. we outperformed the benchmark. That's looking at it at the net asset value level. But as you rightly pointed out, the share price as well has actually done better than that, because we've the discount to net asset value has come in quite a bit, which was very pleased to see. We're very happy with the performance.
That's great, Matthew. Thank you very much. Matthew Tillett, of course, the lead portfolio manager for Brunner Investment Trust. And that's all we have time for in this episode of The Connected Investor. Thank you for joining us. Make sure you smash that subscribe button, as the young people say, to make sure that you get your updated version of the podcast whenever we put one out in wherever you get your podcast, whether that's Acast or Apple or whatever. So thank you all for listening. And remember, you can share your views on what we said. Get in touch with us through the website. It is www.brunner.co.uk. From Matthew and from me, Joe Lynham, thank you.
Thank you.